Hey guys, before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. So if you're prepping for the Series 82, they have this full course with adaptive study quizzes and smart flashcards and unlimited practice exams weighted exactly like the real thing. It's really cool. You can check it out at certfuel.com.
Yeah, it's honestly an incredible tool for making sure these highly technical concepts actually stick when you're under exam pressure.
Absolutely. Okay, so picture this. You are standing in a sterile, fluorescent-lit bank lobby. You're holding a literal duffel bag stuffed with $50 million of other people's money. The clock on the wall is ticking down to midnight.
A very stressful situation.
Right. And if you deposit that bag into the wrong account, you lose your professional license and your livelihood. But if you hand that bag to the business owner who hired you just 1 minute too early, well, you could face federal charges.
Yeah, welcome to the terrifying high-stakes mechanics of private financial distributions.
Exactly. It's wild. So our mission for you, the listener today, as you're prepping for your Series 82 exam, is to master these mechanics. We are going to strip away all that textbook jargon and look at the raw physics of a deal.
Because we really need to understand how the offering moves from the issuer's brain into the investor's portfolio, right?
Yeah, and more importantly, who absorbs the catastrophic risk when the market just goes completely cold? And where physically and legally does that giant duffel bag of investor cash sit while everyone is sweating and waiting to see if a deal actually closes?
Well, the foundational concept to keep in your mind here is that this entire ecosystem is built around assigning risk and responsibility.
Yeah.
Like every single rule we are going to dissect today exists because at some point in financial history, someone exploited a loophole.
Oh, yeah, someone definitely ran off with the duffel bag.
Exactly. Or they left an innocent party holding the bag when a deal collapsed. So if you can track the risk, if you know who gets burned when things go wrong,
Yeah.
you will instantly understand the why behind the regulation.
And understanding that why is the ultimate cheat code for this exam, it's way better than just rote memorizing flashcards.
100%.
So to keep this ADHD friendly and grounded in reality, we are going to follow a single high stakes deal from the initial handshake all the way to the final payout. And we're going to use a recurring cast of characters.
That always helps make it stick.
Right. So first up, we have Sam, the sponsor. Sam is our issuer. He has developed this revolutionary new geothermal energy technology. It's brilliant, but it's super capital intensive. He is completely broke and needs to raise $50 million to build his first commercial plant.
Which means Sam desperately needs a distribution mechanism because he cannot legally or practically raise that kind of capital
Yeah.
by just knocking on doors in his neighborhood.
He'd be walking around a long time. So that brings in our second character, Riley the Rep. Riley is a registered broker-dealer who operates as a placement agent.
Also known as a dealer manager in these larger syndicate deals.
Right. So Riley is the seasoned Wall Street veteran hired to actually go out and market this geothermal offering and convince people to part with their capital.
And the person they were trying to convince is our third character, Ingrid the Investor.
Yes, Ingrid.
She represents the prospective buyer. Ingrid is a high net worth individual. She has liquid cash she wants to deploy. She's hunting for yield, and she is the direct target of Riley's sophisticated sales pitch.
Perfect. Sam, the sponsor, Riley, the rep, and Ingrid, the investor. Basically, the entire Series 82 curriculum revolves around the legal friction between these three people.
It really does.
So let's start at the very beginning of the timeline. Sam walks into Riley's mahogany-paneled office. Sam needs $50 million. Riley says, "Well, I can get you that money, but it's going to cost you." They negotiate and they sign a placement agent agreement.
And looking at the sources, this isn't just a basic service contract. This document carries immense structural weight for the entire offering.
Yeah, it's the absolute bedrock of the deal. So the placement agent agreement does three heavily tested things right. First, it explicitly names who is legally responsible for the mechanics of the offering.
Right, establishing Riley as the dealer manager.
Yep. Second, it fixes the selling basis, which dictates whether Riley or Sam is taking on the financial risk of the deal failing. We'll get into that later.
And third, it sets the clock. It defines the offering period.
Let's pull on that thread for a second because before I started studying this stuff, I totally assumed that if Sam hires Riley to raise 50 million, Riley just pitches the geothermal plant at every cocktail party for the next 5 years until the money is raised.
Yeah, a lot of people assume that, but the regulations definitely do not allow for an infinite runway.
Not at all.
An offering period is a strict, rigidly defined window of time. It's codified in the offering documents with a specific start date and a specific end date.
Right.
This is the only legally permissible window during which Riley the rep can actually solicit investors and accept subscriptions for Sam's plant.
But why the strict timer, though? Like, why does the SEC care if it takes Riley 2 months or 2 years to raise the cash?
Well, because time degrades information. I mean, the core philosophy of federal securities law is full and fair disclosure.
Oh, right. So the business plan gets stale.
Exactly. When Sam writes his financial projections and risk factors, those are essentially a snapshot in time. If you let an offering float out in the ether indefinitely, market conditions will wildly fluctuate.
Yeah, competitors emerge, interest rates spike.
Right, so if Riley is pitching Ingrid 2 years after the document was written, the information Ingrid relies on is dangerously obsolete. The fixed offering period forces the raise to happen while the disclosures are still fresh and accurate.
That makes perfect sense. It's basically an expiration date on the validity of the pitch.
Okay.
So the clock starts ticking. Riley has, let's say, 90 days to raise this $50 million.
Okay.
Riley secures a lunch meeting with Ingrid the investor. Riley breaks down the geothermal technology, shows her the projected yields, and walks through the tax advantages. It's just a masterful presentation.
Riley is very good at this.
Super good. So at the end of lunch, Ingrid wipes her mouth, looks at Riley, and says, "This sounds amazing. Put me down for $100,000. I'm in."
A phenomenal outcome for Riley's afternoon.
But here's the critical mechanics question for you, the listener. Okay, so Riley pitches the deal, and Ingrid says, "Put me down for $100,000. Is Ingrid legally locked in? Just take a beat and think about it.
Yeah, consider what actually happened there.
No!
She is not.
This is actually one of the most frequent traps on the exam. Because what Ingrid just provided over lunch is known in the industry as an indication of interest or an IOI.
An indication of interest. It sounds really official, but it's fundamentally hollow, legally speaking.
Exactly. An IOI is a prospective investor's non-binding expression of interest. The key word that you must burn into your memory for the exam is non-binding.
Non-binding, right.
It's gathered during that strict offering period, but it is not a purchase. It's not a contract. It is simply Ingrid raising her hand and saying, "I like the look of this. Hold a spot in line for me while I think about it." I always try to map this to everyday e-commerce. It's exactly like putting a $100,000 item into your online shopping cart. You haven't bought the item just because it's sitting in the cart.
Yeah, you haven't entered your credit card. You haven't clicked confirm purchase.
Exactly. The IOI is just a shopping cart.
That's a perfect operational analogy. And the exam writers know that human nature assumes a verbal yes is a sale. They will present a fact pattern where an investor enthusiastically agrees to buy, and the question will ask at this moment, has a sale occurred?
And you have to spot the illusion. The sale has not happened. So what actually triggers the legal threshold of a sale? Like, how does Riley turn that shopping cart into a closed deal?
Well, it requires two highly specific sequential actions. First, Ingrid the investor must formally execute a subscription agreement.
That's the dense, legally binding contract, right?
Yes, where she commits her capital and makes her representations and warranties, like legally verifying that she is, in fact, an accredited investor.
But even Ingrid signing that massive document isn't the end of the line, is it?
No, it's a two-way street. The second mandatory action is that Sam, the sponsor, the issuer, must formally evaluate and accept that subscription agreement.
Ah, Sam has to sign off.
Sam or his general partner has to sign off on the counterparty. Until both of those signatures are on that specific agreement, Ingrid can walk away without penalty. And crucially, Sam has the right to refuse her money.
But why would Sam refuse her money if he's desperate for $50 million?
Because of the liability layer. What if Sam's compliance team reviews Ingrid's subscription agreement and realizes she doesn't actually meet the wealth thresholds to be an accredited investor?
Oh, wow. So if Sam accepts her money, he blows up his own private placement exemption.
Exactly. He suddenly finds himself running an illegal, unregistered public offering. So the two-signature requirement protects the issuer just as much as the investor.
That is a massive insight. The deal isn't done until the issuer verifies the investor is safe to take money from. Okay, so we're going to put a pin in these indications of interest for now, because later when we talk about pricing, these non-binding shopping carts are actually the most powerful weapon Riley has.
They really are.
But for now, the 90-day clock is ticking. Riley is gathering IOIs, but Riley quickly realizes a mathematical reality. You can't raise $50 million having one-on-one lunches.
No, there just isn't enough time in the offering period.
Right. So Riley needs to broadcast this deal to hundreds of Ingrids, which means Riley has to distribute the core disclosure document, the private placement memorandum, or PPM.
The PPM is the holy grail document of any private offering. If the subscription agreement is the contract, the PPM is the encyclopedia.
It contains every material fact about Sam's geothermal plant, right? The geological risks, the financial projections, the executive team's background, all of it.
Yes. And Riley, functioning as the dealer manager, has a strict operational duty regarding this document.
And this is a distinction that the study materials hammer repeatedly. Riley's specific duty in the context of this unit, which is the mechanics of distribution, is delivery.
Yes, physical or secure digital transmission of the PPM to prospective investors. And this is where candidates often scramble their knowledge.
How so?
You have to keep your conceptual bucket separate for the exam. The duty to deliver the document is an operational mechanic. The duty to verify that the contents of the document are actually true, which is due diligence, is a completely separate regulatory obligation.
Okay, so if the exam asks about Riley's role in the distribution process, I shouldn't be looking for answers about Riley flying out to inspect the geothermal drilling sites to make sure Sam isn't lying.
Exactly. Due diligence is vital, and you'll be tested on it in another section. But when the question is isolated to distribution mechanics, the focus is strictly on the chain of custody of information.
Did Riley successfully and compliantly deliver the disclosures to Ingrid? Keep delivery completely walled off in your mind from investigative fact-checking.
Spot on. Delivery is the name of the game here.
Got it. But again, Riley is just one broker-dealer firm. To raise $50 million in 90 days, Riley needs an army, a syndicate. So Riley decides to build what the industry calls a selling group.
Building a selling group is how Wall Street scales distribution. Riley looks across the landscape of other fine array registered broker-dealers and says, I have this highly attractive offering from Sam. My firm can only place about $20 million of it.
Right.
I need partners to place the remaining $30 million. Who wants to join my group and sell this to your own clients for a cut of the fees?
Let's use a nightlife analogy here because it maps perfectly to the contractual reality of a selling group. Imagine Sam, the sponsor, isn't building a geothermal plant, but he's opening a massive 5,000-person mega club in Miami.
Yeah, I'm tracking.
Sam is the owner. He needs the club packed to capacity on opening night. He hires Riley to be the master event planner, the head promoter.
Uh-huh.
But Riley can't personally hand out 5,000 flyers.
Right.
So Riley goes out and hires a dozen independent street-level party promoters to blast their own text lists and bring their own crowds. Those street-level promoters are the selling group.
That analogy holds up beautifully because it perfectly illustrates the legal concept of privity of contract. In your nightclub scenario, Sam, the owner, signs a master contract with Riley, the event planner.
Right, the master contract.
But then Riley turns around and signs completely separate individual contracts with each of those street-level promoters. This second layer of contracts is called the selling group agreement.
And here is the brutal exam trap that catches so many people. You have to trace the ink on the page. The selling group agreement is a contract entirely between Riley, the dealer manager, and the individual selling group members.
Yes. Sam, the sponsor, the actual issuer of the securities, is not a party to the selling group agreement. His signature is nowhere on it.
This concept is incredibly testable because it defines the chain of liability. Let's say one of your street-level party promoters goes rogue. They start printing their own unauthorized flyers with illegal promises.
Or, in our financial context, a selling group member fails to deliver the PPM to their clients, or they make fraudulent promises about the geothermal yield.
If I'm one of those defrauded clients, my instinct is to sue the guy whose name is on the building. I'm going to sue Sam, the sponsor.
And you might try, but the contractual obligations of that rogue broker run exclusively to Riley, the dealer manager. They do not run directly to Sam, the issuer.
Even though everyone is ultimately selling Sam's geothermal stock.
Exactly. The chain of command and the chain of contractual liability funnels strictly through Riley.
So it creates a firewall. The selling group member answers to Riley. Riley answers to Sam. If a selling group member violates FINRA rules, Riley is the one who has to answer for failing to supervise their syndicate.
Precisely. Riley enforces the breach of contract against the selling group member. The selling group agreement is a highly detailed document. It dictates their allocations, standards of conduct, and exactly how they are going to get paid.
Which brings us to slicing the spread. Because when I first read about financial underwriting, I assumed the spread was just a giant monolithic pile of cash.
Like a canvas sack with $5 million in it.
Yeah. Like Sam raises $50 million, the fee is 10%, so there's just a giant sack of cash, and all the brokers just dive into it and grab what they can. But the sources are very clear that this compensation is highly structured.
It is surgically divided. The gross spread is rarely just one number. It is comprised of distinct pieces, each compensating a different type of labor. And the exam will invariably isolate one single piece and ask you to identify it based on a functional description.
Okay, let's slice it open. What are the primary components?
You're generally looking at three components. First, the dealer manager fee. Second, the selling group commission. And third, non-cash compensation. Let's start with the dealer manager fee. Who do you think receives this?
Well, based on the title, this has to go exclusively to Riley.
Correct. It is compensation paid strictly to the head of the syndicate for the labor of organizing, managing, and coordinating the entire distribution apparatus.
So going back to the nightclub, this is the fee Riley earns just for being the master event planner. Riley gets this money for designing the strategy, drafting the agreements, and managing the central book of orders.
Exactly. Riley earns this management fee regardless of whether Riley personally picks up a phone and sells a single share to an investor. It's for administrative overhead.
Right. So contrast that with the second piece, the selling group commission.
Sometimes called the selling concession. This is the compensation paid to a selling group member exclusively for the securities it actually places with end investors.
Ah, the classic eat what you kill model.
Entirely. If brokerage firm X is given an allocation of $5 million worth of stock to sell, but they only manage to convince their clients to buy $1 million worth, they only earn the commission percentage on that $1
million. So the street-level promoter only gets their bounty for the specific heads that walk through the front door. They don't get paid based on the $5 million they hope to sell.
That's right. The commission is strictly tied to units placed.
And what about the third slice? Non-cash compensation. This feels like the wild card.
It is the wild card, and it's heavily scrutinized by regulators. Sometimes, to heavily incentivize the placement agent, Sam the sponsor might offer equity kickers.
Like warrants.
Yes. Instead of just a cash fee, Sam might say, Riley, if you successfully raise this $50 million all, I will also grant you warrants to purchase 100,000 shares of my geothermal company at a steep discount in the future.
So Riley gets a piece of the upside. If the company goes public, those warrants could be worth tens of millions. It aligns Riley's long-term interests with Sam's.
It does, but it also creates massive conflicts of interest, which is why FANRI requires extensive disclosure of all non-cash compensation in the offering documents. Ingrid, the investors, has a right to know that Riley's aggressive pitch might be fueled by the promise of lucrative warrants.
That makes sense. For the exam, your task is simple. Read the fact pattern. If the text describes a fee for coordinating the distribution select dealer manager fee, if it describes pay per unit successfully placed select selling group commission.
Perfect summary.
All right, here's where it gets really interesting. I want a pattern interrupt here. Riley has the syndicate organized. They take the PPM, they swarm the market, and they start pitching to Ingrid and thousands of other wealthy investors. But what if the market just says no?
The nightmare scenario.
Yeah. What if a major news story breaks about geothermal plants causing earthquakes and suddenly no one wants to buy Sam's stock? The 90-day clock is ticking down. They've only raised $10 million out of the $50 million. Who gets stuck with $40 million of unsold, unwanted stock?
You have just arrived at the absolute core of the Series 82 distribution mechanics. How did these parties contractually allocate the risk of a failed raise?
We are getting into the five methods of distribution, and I want to emphasize something our sources state explicitly because it changes how you should study this. These five labels, firm commitment standby, best efforts, all or none, and minimax, are not hyper-specific SEC definitions.
That is a vital contextual point. You cannot go to the Code of Federal Regulations and find a paragraph that perfectly defines best efforts. These are industry vocabulary terms.
Market practices.
Yes, they evolved over a century of underwriting. But related federal rules use these market terms as triggers for immense regulatory obligations. So you have to know them cold as risk allocation mechanisms.
And the only foolproof way to map them in your head for the exam is to divide them into two strict categories based on one question. Who absorbs the shortfall? Who is left holding the bag? Let's start with the most aggressive category.
The scenarios where Riley, the rep, the agent, absorbs the risk.
Yes. So the crown jewel of this category is the firm commitment.
In a firm commitment distribution, Riley acts as a principal, not an agent. Riley actually purchases the entire block of securities from Sam up front, utilizing Riley's own capital, and then Riley attempts to resell those securities to the public at a markup.
Wait, let me make some legalizing this. Before Riley sells a single share to Ingrid, Riley writes a check for $50 million from the broker-dealer's own treasury, hands it to Sam, and takes possession of the stock.
Yes. The transaction between the issuer and the underwriter executes immediately. which means Sam has achieved ultimate victory on day one. Sam has his guaranteed $50 million. His capital risk is zero.
But Riley's risk is now astronomical. If that earthquake news story breaks the next day and Riley can't resell those securities to the public, what happens?
Riley eats the entire loss. The unsold securities sit on the broker-dealer's inventory, tying up their net capital and potentially driving the firm into insolvency. Riley absorbs 100% of the market shortfall.
That is the ultimate gamble. Why would a broker-dealer ever agree to a firm commitment?
Because taking on massive principal risk demands massive compensation. In a firm commitment, the spread is significantly wider. If Riley correctly gauges market demand and instantly resells the whole block, Riley makes an absolute fortune overnight.
Okay, so firm commitment is the agent buying the whole pie up front. What is the second method where Riley takes the risk?
The second method is called a standby agreement. In a standby arrangement, Riley commits on a firm principal basis to purchase whatever portion of the offering is not successfully placed with the public by the end of the offering period.
Let's do a direct mechanical comparison here, because these two sound dangerously similar. In both firm commitment and standby, Riley is on the hook to buy the unsold securities, right? How do I tell them apart?
You focus relentlessly on the timing trigger. The allocation of risk is the same, but the chronological execution is the exact opposite. In a firm commitment, the purchase is the very first thing that happens. Day one, Riley buys the whole pie, then spends 90 days trying to sell slices.
Upfront execution.
Precisely. In a standby agreement, Riley's purchase obligation is the very last thing that happens. It is a cleanup duty. For 90 days, Sam and Riley use their best efforts to sell the pie to the public.
And if they sell it all, Riley buys nothing.
Right. But if the clock strikes midnight on day 90, and they've only sold $40 million, then Riley's standby commitment triggers. Riley is legally forced to step in and buy the remaining $10 million shortfall.
So firm commitment is upfront risk. Standby is cleanup duty at the buzzer. In both scenarios, Sam sleeps perfectly at night. Okay, let's flip the board. What about the second major category where the issuer Sam absorbs the risk?
This brings us to best efforts. It is the baseline standard for private placements. In a best efforts distribution, Riley agrees only to try really, really hard to sell the securities. But crucially, Riley takes absolutely no principal position.
No firm capital at risk. So they run the 90-day period, pitch the plan everywhere, but the market is lukewarm. They only raise $15 million out of 50. What happens?
The offering simply closes at $15 million. Sam receives the $15 million minus fees. The remaining $35 million worth of stock is simply never issued. It vanishes.
And Sam has a massive problem. He needed $50 million to build the plant. Now he has $15 million, which isn't enough to pour the foundation, but he has all these new investors demanding a return. Sam absorbed the entire risk of the shortfall.
That is the harsh reality of a straight best efforts deal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because raising only a fraction of the necessary capital can actually be worse than raising nothing at all, the market evolved two highly specific variants of best efforts.
The contingency variants.
Yes. The first is all or none, or AON. It is a variant of best efforts with a single brutal binary trigger. Sell the entire stated amount or cancel the whole thing and refund everyone.
So if it's a $50 million AON raise, exactly $50 million must be raised. What if Riley has an incredible run and they collect $49.9 million? They're just a fraction short. Does Sam get the money?
No, the contingency failed. The entire deal is unwound. Every single signed subscription agreement is voided.
Yeah.
Every dollar collected from Ingrid and the others must be returned to them in full. Mm-hmm. Sam gets zero. Riley gets zero.
Wow. A single catastrophic trigger. All or nothing. What is the logic behind this from the investor's perspective? Why would Ingrid want an AON contingency?
It's a massive protection mechanism for Ingrid. If Sam only raises $10 million, he can't execute the business plan, which means Ingrid's money is stranded in a doomed enterprise. The AON contingency guarantees her money is only locked up if Sam secures the full war chest he needs.
That is brilliant. Okay, what is the second best efforts variant?
The second variant is called Minimax. It utilizes two distinct thresholds, a floor and a ceiling.
How does that look in our scenario?
Sam and Riley might say, okay, $50 million is our dream scenario, our maximum ceiling. But realistically, we can build a smaller scale-down plant for $20 million. $20 million is our absolute minimum floor to make this a viable business.
So if Riley only raises $10 million by the end of the period?
They miss the floor. The deal is canceled, everything gets refunded. But let's say on day 45, Riley successfully hits the $20 million floor.
What happens then? Does the offering stop?
No, but the legal state of the offering transforms. The contingency has been officially met. The offering is now live. Sam is guaranteed at least $20 million, and Riley can continue aggressively selling the remaining $30 million up to the ceiling.
Okay, listener, direct question for you. So if the exam asks, in a mini-max offering, if the minimum threshold is not met, does the placement agent absorb the risk of the unsold shares? Take a second.
Yeah, think about who really loses out there.
No. The issuer absorbs it by getting zero funding. AON and Minimax never put the agent at risk.
That is a classic exam trap. Yeah. Candidates confuse it with a standby or firm commitment. You must remember, best efforts AON and Minimax only define when the issuer gets nothing instead of something.
Yeah.
The agent Riley never ever buys the shortfall.
Right. So since firm commitment means Riley has to buy the whole thing, how on earth do Riley and Sam figure out the right price to charge Ingrid?
This is a profound challenge off exchange. In a public IPO, you have public book building. But here, price discovery happens in the shadows.
So they just negotiate.
Raw negotiation. It is a one-on-one battle of leverage.
And this is where those non-binding IOIs from earlier come back into play. The shopping carts.
Yes. The pile of IOIs Riley collected acts as a barometer of demand. Strong demand. Lots of IOIs. Means Sam can demand a higher price.
Like $15 a share, take it or leave it.
Exactly. Weak demand means the price gets pushed down aggressively or the deal size shrinks. The IOIs dictate the leverage in the room.
And the distribution method shapes the negotiation too, right? In a firm commitment, Riley is taking on massive pricing risk because they're locking in a purchase price up front.
Right. So Riley's going to fight ferociously to push the price down as low as possible to protect their downside. But in a best efforts deal, Sam takes the pricing risk. So Sam tries to push the price as high as possible without breaking the deal.
It's a beautifully cohesive system.
Ugh.
Okay, so Sam and Riley agree on a price, and they decide to run an all-or-none offering. Or wait, let's say a mini-max offering.
A mini-max.
The offering period starts. Riley pitches Ingrid. Ingrid signs the binding subscription agreement and hands Riley a certified check for $500,000. But the $20 million floor hasn't been met yet. So what happens to Ingrid's money while everyone sits around waiting?
This brings us to SEC Rule 15(c)(2)-(4). The paired rule for contingency offerings and payment handling.
The giant duffel bag rule.
Yes. The rule has two halves. Rule one governs the promise. If you call it an all or none or mini max, you cannot lie. You must hit the stated amount within the stated time, and the seller must receive payment by a specified date.
Now, exam trap alert. The rule says within the specified time. Does the SEC rule dictate a fixed number of days, like 30 days or 90 days?
No. There is no fixed number of days in the federal rule. The deadline is whatever the offering document promised. If they wrote 14 days, it's 14 days. If they fail, refunds must be prompt.
Okay, that's rule one. Rule two is where the physical money sits. Can Riley just put Ingrid's 500 grand into their company checking account?
Absolutely not. That is commingling. The money must go to one of two permissible, legally insulated places. Option one, promptly deposited in a separate bank account, with Riley acting strictly as an agent or trustee for the beneficial owners.
A walled-off trust account? And option two.
Option two, promptly transmitted to an independent bank holding the funds in escrow with a written agreement.
Direct comparison exam trap here. The exam will try to trick you into thinking the independent bank escrow is somehow safer or better than the broker's trust account. Are they different?
They are completely equal under the regulation. Neither holding method is preferred.
Okay, but what about a firm commitment? Does this escrow rule apply if Riley bought the whole issue up front?
This is a massive exception. Firm commitments are 100% exemptee meo from both halves of this rule.
Because there's no sales contingency to misrepresent. Riley already bought it. There's no minimum floor left to hit.
Precisely. The exemption actually sits in the opening words of the rule. It completely carves out firm commitments.
Okay, the money is safely locked away in a separate bank account. But while Riley is out there hustling to sell the rest of the deal, what rules govern how Riley actually speaks to Ingrid? Since it's off exchange, can Riley just lie?
No, Riley's a broker-dealer, so ordinary conduct rules apply.
Yeah.
Fair dealing, no misleading communications. But there's a specific broker-dealer anti-fraud rule for off-exchange trades. It explicitly makes it unlawful for Riley to use any manipulative or deceptive device.
Now, I need you to untangle this for me. The sources discuss the regulatory anti-fraud rule, but then also civil liability. What's the difference?
It dictates who is punishing you. Regulatory anti-fraud rule is enforced by the SEC and FINRA. They can fine you, suspend your license, ban you from the industry. That's the police.
Okay. And civil liability?
Civil liability is a private right of action. If the PPM lies, Ingrid, the investor can actually sue Riley and Sam directly to get her money back, plus damages.
So Evan RA goes after your career, Ingrid goes after your bank account.
Precisely. And a tiny nuance to flag the off-exchange rule applies the same bar to municipal securities dealers, but only for municipal securities, not everything they touch.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to throw a wild hypothetical at you. What if Sam, the sponsor, hates paying Riley the dealer manager fee? What if Sam just tells his own internal HR manager, let's call him Eddie, hey, you go sell these securities to Ingrid?
You have just stumbled into the Associated Persons safe harbor, selling without broker registration.
So Eddie works for Sam. He's not a registered broker. Can Eddie sell the deal?
Maybe, but he has to pass three strict baseline conditions first. One, no statutory disqualification, no criminal history of fraud.
Makes sense. Two.
Two, no transaction-based pay.
Yeah.
Sam cannot pay Eddie a commission. He must just get his normal HR salary.
Because commissions create a salesman's bias.
Right? Exactly. And three, he cannot be associated with a broker-dealer at the time.
Okay, so Eddie passes the baseline. No crime, no commission, no broker ties. Is he cleared to pitch Ingrid?
No. He must now fit into one of three participation paths. Path one is limited purchaser. Eddie only sells to specific institutional heavyweights like banks, insurers, or registered investment companies.
So he couldn't sell to Ingrid, the wealthy individual, under path one.
Correct. Path two is incidental duties. Eddie has a real day job-like HR manager and primarily does that.
But wait, there's a trap here, right? The once every 12 months rule.
Yes. Eddie can only use this path to sell securities once every 12 months. For shelf registration, the clock runs from the last sale within that registration. This cap only applies to the incidental duties path.
Okay, and path three?
Passive communication.
Yeah.
Eddie doesn't open his mouth to solicit. He just mails out pre-approved written communications or does purely clerical work.
So direct question to the listener. If Eddie fails one of these baseline conditions, say he gets a tiny $50 commission, is he automatically guilty of being an unregistered broker? Think about it.
Yeah, consider what a safe harbor actually is.
No, losing the safe harbor does not automatically make you a broker.
Exactly. It just means you lose the legal presumption of safety. Regulators will now judge you under ordinary broker registration rules based on all the facts.
The harbor is a shield, not a trapdoor. And there's one last massive caveat, right? The outside finder trap.
Yes, this safe harbor only applies to the issuer's own associated persons, like Eddie the employee. It never applies to an outside unregistered finder who introduces people for a fee. Let's call him Frankie the Finder.
Keep Eddie the employee and Frankie the Finder totally separate in your mind.
Okay,
my brain is vibrating. Let's do a rapid-fire recap of the most testable takeaways.
Let's do it.
Takeaway one, selling group obligations. Run to the dealer manager, Riley, not the issuer.
Takeaway two, firm commitment absorbs risk up front. Best efforts shifts risk to the issuer.
Takeaway three, AON and Minimax contingencies require money to sit in a separate bank account as agent or trustee or are a written escrow agreement. Neither is better. And firm commitments are entirely exempt.
Takeaway four, the safe harbor requires three baseline conditions and one of three paths. The 12-month limit only applies to the incidental duties path.
Boom. Incredible. We've mapped the plumbing of the deal. Expert, you have a final provocative thought for us.
Yeah, we talked about how IOIs shape pricing, right? But think about the psychology of the mini-max threshold. Once that $20 million minimum floor is hit and the deal is officially live, how might Riley, the placement agent, use that momentum to induce FOMO in the remaining investors up to the ceiling?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, how does the removal of the contingency entirely change the pitch? The regulatory mechanics actually dictate human behavior.
The shopping cart becomes a desperate race to the checkout line. I love that. All right, well, that is our deep dive into the mechanics of distribution and placement agents. We hope this gave you the clarity you need. Good luck on your Series 82 prep. Keep reviewing those CertFuel flashcards, and we will see you on the next deep dive.